Oh, okay.
So we're pleased to have Robert Digraph again for the second installment in his series.
Well, which actually is, since the first talk was kind of the chapter zero, this is actually kind of chapter one. So the thing I want to explain essentially in these two lectures is that there is, in some sense, some very nice mathematical precise results about, among other things, about matrix models, but it's related to many other model aspects that I would really like to call kind of quantum curves, in the sense that these are structures associated to a Riemann surface together with a parameter that we can kind of identify as h-bar or Planck's constant. So we get some kind of a non-commutative version of Riemann surface in. And let me first set up what are the kind of structures that we're looking in. So these are structures coming from string theory. So we will compute kind of certain invariants, and they will depend on two sets of parameters. So there will be moduli, which I just denote with some variables t1, tn, and then there will be a thing called the string coupling constant, which you call lambda, and you, for many reasons, you can identify as h-bar. It will, in many circumstances, really play the role, traditional role of Planck's constant, and then we will compute partition functions that have a generic, at least asymptotic expansion of the following type. There will be some here, and then they will depend, they will have an expansion in powers essentially of lambda squared times some functions fg of the moduli. So these are the things that we want to compute, and these fgs are associated to maps of kind of string world sheets or Riemann surface of genus G into some space X. So we will have functions of this type, and these functions appear in many, many different places. So let me mention a few of these places where they appear, and and then we will start to describe this in more detail. So the first place where these things appear is in the theory of random matrices. So essentially means that this partition function Z will be associated to an integral over n by n matrices of some, here we'll have some general kind of potential, which I write here generically as trace a W of X. W, some polynomial. So there's a big class of these kind of random matrix integrals, and I will say in a moment how they lead to these kind of expansions, but then these will be one of our prime examples. A second important example is so-called Gromov of Witten invariants of toric collabial threefolds, and in that case the functions fg as a function of t will have an expansion in terms of other invariants, the so-called Gromov-Witten invariants, gd e to the minus dt. So they will have essentially a Fourier expansion in terms of t, and here so what we are having here is literally the mapping curves of genus g inside our space X of a fixed degree d, and so these are formally defined in terms of some moduli space of maps into X, and then you compute the so-called virtual fundamental class and integrate it, and these are these Gromov-Witten invariants, and in general these are some rational numbers. So that's another place where functions like that appear. A third very closely related one is essentially these invariants of sheaves, so the so-called Donaldson-Thomas invariant, There the FGs themselves don't have a good interpretation, but the total partition function Z then has an expansion. So this is related to what I was mentioning about these quantum crystals in the talk on Tuesday. So here we basically look at sheaves of rank 1 on X, and then there is a D which can be interpreted as the second Chern class, and there's a second integer N which can be turned as the third Chern character, and then there is a sum here over all of these bundles with essentially here the Donaldson-Thomas invariants, which are counting the number of these sheaves. And here it has a different expansion here, lambda, but so if you wish, this you can think of as a Fourier expansion of the partition function both in the variable lambda and in the variable t, where these objects over here, if you look at this expansion, it's like a Taylor expansion in lambda and a Fourier expansion in t. So this is a good interpretation for lambda small, and this is in some sense an interpretation in the limit when lambda goes to infinity. There is a fourth kind of place where structures like this appear that perhaps I should mention. It's something that Sergei knows much more about, but there's also a place where these structures appear in the theory of knot invariants. And I will say something about that, I think, later. I think at the moment I want to concentrate on these examples. So, what I want to do now is I want to go in more detail in the specific example of the random matrices, because, as I was telling in my first lecture, what I find very exciting is that we now have, in some sense, a quite complete control with the nice proven mathematical theorems of how to think of these partition functions FG for arbitrary genus G. And so, let me say something about that.
So, can I just ask you a general question about the form of
yes.
the partition function?
Yes.
It would look more usual to me if the exponential is inside the sum, if you were taking a sum of weights.
So that was, for instance, this Donaldson-Thomas was a sum of weights, but this is more like a graphical expansion. So it's like if you, in some sense, taking the exponential here is taking the connected graphs, where you take a sum over all graphs. Yes. But indeed, the remarkable thing is that in many cases you have the function that has all these different expansions. And in some sense, there's a mathematical story connected to all these different expansions. Yes. So the case that we are, let me say something first of kind of the kind of the geometrical setup that we're interested in. So we are interested in curves, but we are interested in plane curves. And I think the more general setting would be the following. So we start from a space B, which I think in a more general setting, so this would be a hypercalor manifold. And will be of complex dimension too, so it's also a complex surface. And perhaps you want to think it as a product of two elliptic curves. So this would be kind of topologically four torus. And then we're interested in kind of various degenerations of this. So we're interested in generations of B. And there are two which we are particularly interested in, the case where B is just C cross C. And the second case where B is C star cross C star. Now, on that space, I basically want to think of this as a kind of a complexified phase space. So on the space, I have a symplectic form, an holomorphic symplectic form, which in these two examples would be dx wedge dy. And here it would be dx over x, which dy over y. So the, so that would be the natural choice of this kind of holomorphic symplectic form. So we have this kind of so picture. So let's think of here as C2 with coordinates x and y. And then there is this symplectic form living on it. And then we want to consider curves in that space. So we want this together with a curve. So, and in the case of C2 will be, for instance, given by an algebraic curve. So we have some curve given by, say, an equation fxy equal to 0. So here is a curve C given by this equation. Now, in particular, if you if this is a holomorphic curve, and you restrict this holomorphic symplectic form to C, it will be cohomologically trivial, so we can write it as kind of del of eta, when eta is in this case a one form. So it's an holomorphic one form. So in usual kind of classical mechanics, this would be the Liouville form. And you could think of, so x and y, you could think of coordinates and momenta. C, you could think of, for instance, a level set of a Hamiltonian, where f is the Hamiltonian. And then eta would be the Liouville form, which is usually write as PDQ or something. So there's a one form, and I think that's quite important. So in this setup, we have a, so the system that we have a curve C together with this kind of one form eta. And it's to this object that we will start to associate certain invariants. Now, this let me now say how these geometries are related to the systems that we are studying before. So the first thing is that these systems are very naturally associated to, there's a very natural way to lift this or to a Calabi-Yau threefold. So it's kind of a very canonical way to lift this to a Calabi-Yau threefold by looking at an equation. So let's again take the case where B is just a complex plane. Then we look at the Calabi-Yau threefold will be a hypersurface inside C4 given by the equation WZ plus this F xy equal to 0. So if you want to think about this kind of in a picture, if here is the xy plane and here is the curve given by f equal to 0, then you can think of this as a vibration of a curve. So over it is the curve wz minus f or plus f equals 0, and you see when f, so on the generic point, this looks something like this. It's kind of given by a smooth curve, but over these singularities, it degenerates like this. So this is a kind of a natural. So there's a natural Calabi-Yau threefold associated to the curve, which is this space X. And the theory that we are, the cases that we are considering. So we'll always be talking about cases where we have this kind of holomorphic curve C. But it will be related to applications to Calabi-Yau threefolds, but it will always be given in this particular type, or their mirrors. Now, something that is already known for some time, as we briefly review, that these curves, together with the choice of one form, they make their appearance in various physical theories, but in particular in the random matrix models. So let me briefly explain how that works. So, if you have a random matrix model of the following type, so we look at the matrix model like this, and suppose that W is a polynomial of degree n plus 1, then we can look at its critical points, so W prime, say, at ai equal to 0. So, W is some polynomial
we look at it, it's critical points, there are n critical points, a1, f2, an.
And then we can look at the saddle point approximation of this integral over these n by n matrices. And the way you do this is you say, well, what is a critical point of this integral? Is that you first think of x, you diagonalize x in terms of its eigenvalues, so lambda 1 up to lambda n. And then the critical points are the points where the eigenvalues of the matrix are located at one of the critical points of W. So what you have to do, you have your n eigenvalues, you have to distribute them over the critical points, and you can introduce moduli, so these are the moduli that appear in the matrix model. You introduce let ni be the number of eigenvalues. So these are the eigenvalues, say lambda I, that are sitting at the ith critical point. So you have you have to partition your capital N. So this will be X is here, an N by N matrix. You have to partition these N eigenvalues in clusters, how you distribute them over their critical points. And this gives these integers, capital N I. And then you introduce the so-called, the moduli will then be given by these combinations, capital N I times lambda, where lambda is essentially the parameter H bar that appears in the matrix model. And the thing that you now want to do is you want to take the limit. This is the usual limit in random matrix theory, the large N limit, where the Ni's go to infinity, lambda goes to zero, but the Ti's are fixed. So what you now have is yes?
You have two different kinds of capital and lowercase n.
Sorry?
So we do the polynomial be n plus 1 on the third line. Is that the same n?
No.
It's not
capital N, no. So you what you're doing, we have here some, we do an integral over capital N, capital is the rank of the matrix, and we pick a polynomial with a finite number of critical points. And this, you could take, for instance, a quadratic polynomial, where you have only a single critical point. And so then there's only a single modulus, which is then N times lambda. So, but in general, you can get lowercase n moduli capital N is sent to infinity, right? Because these, you always have the condition, say, that the sum of the capital N's is the total rank of the matrix. So let me then, the claim is, I can actually say it's a theorem, that this Z, this integral over these n by n matrices has a semi-classical or saddle point approximation around its critical point. That's given by the form, as I said, so it can be written as an exponential of a sum of terms, where the leading term goes like 1 over lambda squared, but then there are sub-leading terms that go with powers of 1 over lambda. And then here there are these functions f, g of t. So these are the functions that we want to compute and understand. So the leading term is f0. So let me say something about that, because that has a very beautiful geometrical interpretation. And the interpretation is the following. So let me just tell you how F0 appears. So the claim is there is a spectral curve C coming out describing the saddle point approximation of this integral, and C is given by the following equation: y squared equals P of x, where P is a polynomial of degree 2n. In fact, it can even be specified. This polynomial P is the derivative of W, which, remember, W was of degree n plus 1, so this is degree n, squared plus a polynomial of degree n minus 1. So if you wish, it's a hyperelliptic curve that is given by this polynomial equation, and this curve in the xy plane encodes the function f0 in the following fashion. So if you think about this, it's a hyperelliptic curve. So if you think of this in the x plane, it has two n branch points. Right, like this. So these are the branch points. So these are the zeros of the polynomial p to n. So it's the curve itself is a double curve over the x plane, and so if you can draw a basis of cycles here. So I'm drawing it both like this, and let me also draw it as a, in some sense, as the double cover. So it has these periods, cycles A1, A2, up to AN. And it has kind of dual cycles, which I can draw like this, B1, up to BN, which here I would draw like this. And not only do we get this curve, but we also have, as I said, there's a natural one form associated to it, which is the one form eta, and that one form is given as y dx. Remind you that d of eta was, in this case, minus dx dy. So this is this Liouville form. So we get this curve, there's a natural one form associated to it, and then we can do the following thing. We can compute the period integrals around these cycles AI of this one form eta, and the claim is that these are given by the periods by the parameters TI, and then the integral around the B cycles of eta is given by the F0 dTi. So this is in some sense a system of equations that tells you if you're given the curve, then the periods of eta should be giving you the values of the moduli ti and this function, the derivatives of f0 with respect to ti. And that means that these parameters t now determine the shape of the curve. So the curve, as I've written it, exists as part of something which is already here in the integral of the matrix model. But this term here, this polynomial f, I didn't tell you what it was. But it should be picked in such a way that the corresponding periods of the mirror morphic one form give you exactly the values of the Ti. So there are n unknown coefficients of this polynomial f, but they get encoded in these n parameters Ti that we fix there. So basically you're given the periods and you have to reconstruct the curve. And then the integrals of the periods of eta essentially give you the function f0. So the theorem is that this f0 is giving you the large n approximation of the matrix integral. But then there's a question, so this is something much more to be said. But then of course the question is, what about the fgs? So in some sense the beautiful thing is that there's a Riemann surface coming out at the large n approximation. But can we say something about the kind of quantum corrections here? Now, there are some partial results that are very promising. For instance, there's something that tells you something about the next to leading correction, which is this coefficient F1. So in many cases, F1 has been computed, and F1 turns out to be given, quite interesting, by the following formula, minus 1/2 the logarithm of the determinant of the Laplacian, the scalar Laplacian on the curve. Well, actually the holomorphic square root. So the determinant of the Laplacian on the Riemann surface is well known to be factorized in terms of a function that's holomorphic times a function that's anti-holomorphic as a function of the moduli, and it's the holomorphic Laplacian that entered here. So this is actually quite suggestive, because these expressions we have seen before, namely in studying field theories on the curve.
So let me remind you that there is a...
If
you are given a Riemann surface C,
there are of course many field theories you can define on it, but a particularly simple one,
which is the field theory, the quantum field theory of a chiral boson on C. So that would have a partition function that defines essentially as some kind of path integral. So phi is here essentially a map from C to R.
So it's the theory where you look at all functions on the Riemann surface,
and then you write down an action for it, and the natural action for it is to write del phi, del bar phi.
So if you compute this partition function, this actually is given by 1 over the square root of the determinant of the Laplacian. So in some sense you can write this in our notations e to the power f1. So I'm not explaining to you here where f0 is coming from, but at least f1 looks like something that you very naturally get from quantum field theory. And so now the question is, well, can also these higher fg's have an interpretation in terms of quantum field theory? Now, string theory tells you yes, it should. In fact,
but I'm sorry.
Yes.
Your interpretation of f0 is quite different. Is that right? It's not a partition function?
It's if you wish, f0 is a completely classical object.
In the sense, it's so what you can do, essentially you can do the following thing. Suppose you have a quantum field theory and you couple this to what you say background gauge field. So if you would couple this, I should have done this. So you introduce say some connection, say a z bar times d phi. You can write a term like this, and now you can pick this connection a to be our one form eta. Then, in fact, if you do this. In fact, I think with perhaps put the lambda here, then you can also compute in some sense the determinant now of this chiral boson. And actually to do it better, then you it's better to make this kind of a circle-valued boson. Then you can also compute its dependence on this background gauge field, and that actually will naturally include F0. So then there will be here also a term F0. So you can include that in a very natural way. Yes. And in fact, this will only depend essentially on the period integrals of this connection A, and that's why only the periods come in. Yes. So both F0 and F1 can be very naturally included in this way. Now, in some sense, so intuition
always was so kind of string theory.
Says in some sense that the FGs, so for instance F2, should be something related to a map of, say, Riemann surface of genus 2, in some sense perhaps mapped into this curve C. So it's a little bit confusing here, because that might be, that's always, confusion point is here there are two types of Riemann surfaces. In some sense, the target space, what we're discussing is a curve, is a Riemann surface. But we're also looking at kind of stringy invariants. So we're looking also at maps of Riemann surface into that fixed target C. And so the FGs that appear in these stringy partition functions have to do with maps of genus D Riemann surfaces mapped into it. But these are different in the sense these are Riemann surfaces, and we, in some sense we are integrating over all possible complex structures here. Well, here we have a fixed curve with a fixed complex structure. And in fact, intuition also is that for these particular string theories, which are so-called topological string theories, these Riemann surfaces are very special in the sense they can be approximated by field theory. So the idea is in some sense that cubic graphs
kind of the right with the right number of vertices, with the right kind of topology, are computing the FGs. But of course the question is, can this be made precise? And the topic I want to talk about today is that it has been made precise, I think, in really beautiful work. Not by me, but yes.
So in particular, the integral is not concentrated on the holomorphic maps.
No, so this is this model, which is called B-model, which is essentially it's concentrated on this almost constant maps.
I see. Okay.
Right, so the bulk of the Riemann surface is in 2 points, and then you get these very degenerate almost constant maps, which look like graphs, and that's why. So in general, this would be a map of Riemann surfaces, but this particular so-called B-model topological string is expected to be a field theory. And so there should be some kind of a cubic field theory, and naively might say, well, you in some sense should include a cubic interaction here, and that would be compute the higher genus contributions. And the beautiful thing is that this model has now been constructed, and I want to explain this, and I also want to explain to you what is, in some sense, a physics or field theory interpretation of that result. So let me quote a nice theorem. So there's a theorem which has been proven by two French mathematical physicists, Aynard and his student Orantin, that gives a complete description of the FGs in terms of combinatorical data. And the first thing is that you have to kind of up the ante in some sense, and not just look at the matrix model, but in general, we can, if you have a matrix model, we can look at, say, expectation values of operators, which means that we integrate the matrix model as we've written it, and then you can also include here some particular combinations, say, traces of X. So this is just notation. I mean by this the normalized partition function, and the thing that we want to consider, the most obvious thing to consider, is the following correlation functions basically include the resolvent of the matrix and look at arbitrary endpoint functions of resolvents of the matrix, and let me give a name to this. This will be called W of x1 up to xn. And
they're all encoded in Z already.
Sorry?
They're all encoded already in Z. So you're not.
If you write a general W here, yeah, you can extract these. Yeah. But it's nicer to write the results in terms of the correlation functions. And in particular, I want to, in some sense, because this has a graphical interpretation, I want to consider the connected part. And then these W's, again, have an expansion in powers of lambda, which is very similar to the... So they, again, have a genus expansion, which now looks as lambda to the 2g minus 2 plus n. There's a natural n appearing here. And then here we have the... say W of G, which is kind of the G-loop contribution to the correlation function. And again, this is a function that depends on the n coordinates. Now, already, in some sense, to set the stage, if you compute the one-point function,
essentially, you're following the old groups.
It's a standard. It's essentially they're solving the loop equation in an elegant way. So this guy already knew, because if you look at this combination, I think you have to include a lambda here plus W prime of x of small x. This is exactly this kind of one form eta. So this is the one form y of x. So the one-point function, in some sense, already made an important appearance in the usual solution of the matrix models, but this is a very natural thing to include the endpoint functions. So now, the statement is that these correlation functions for arbitrary genus, so arbitrary value of G, are entirely geometric in the sense they can be completely given in terms of the geometry of the curve.
So remember, we have this Riemann surface C, which has a certain topology. I guess its genus was N. And remember, this is also perhaps better to draw it like this.
It was some kind of a hyperelliptic curve, right? So I should draw it a little bit like this. So this is C viewed as a kind of a real projection in it.
And so we have these points.
So we pick some branch, x1, x2, xn, and I really want to think of these as points here on the Riemann surface, x1, xn.
So I want to think of this as some sort of a correlation function on the Riemann surface, and then get my... This thing can be computed, and the only thing that you need is the so-called Bergmann kernel of C. So that's a function of two variables. In fact, it's a one form both in Z and W. So it's I guess I should write it like this. And among the physicists, the best way to so this is a function that has a second order pole if Z and W go to zero. And for the physicists, this is in the free field theory of a chiral boson. It's usually written as the 2-point function of two delphis. So it has a pole.
It goes like C minus W squared.
So this is essentially the only ingredient you need, because there's the following recursion relation that fixes these functions f of g. So let me, some sense, first draw the kind of diagram. So the thing what you do is you look at W of, say, you fix one of the coordinates, and then you put, say, n different observables. And so I want to think about this as, here's my Riemann surface, here's W, here's Z1 up to Zn. And the statement is that this can be written as a sum of over all the branch points P. So here there are various branch points on the curve. You write this as a sum of all the branch points, and then make some space. You compute the residue of Z at the branch points. Let me open the bracket and continue here. Of an integral, you write down the expression, it's here we're integrating the Bergmann kernel between two points, Z and Z prime. And I want to say something, so if you are close to the branch point, P, then if you have here a coordinate Z, well, if you have a coordinate X here, it can be lifted to a coordinate Z on the curve, but of course there's also the one on the other sheet, Z tilde. So Z and Z tilde will be the two pairs of points, which if you go very close, of course, are related by the involution of the hyperelliptic curve. Then here you quotient by eta of Z minus eta of Z tilde. And then you multiply this by the function f W of G minus 1. So this, the genus has now been lowered. Coordinate Z, Z tilde, Z1. Up to Zn. And then there's a second term which looks like, well, you have to sum here of all possible ways to split it in two pieces, one of degree h. Let me just write it schematically. And then I draw a diagram. So this thing gets something which looks like this. here a z, here a z tilde. Now suppose this would have been genus 3, then the remaining thing has genus 2, so this is genus g, this is genus g minus 1, and still here everything is coming off, these are still the endpoints. And then the second contribution also looks like this, but now it's a disconnected contribution. Say p is of genus h and p is of genus g minus h, here are the points z and z tilde, and again we have some way and distributed the remaining endpoints over the two components. So this is a combinatorial thing, because if you look how it works, what you're doing, you're expressing the contribution at G loop in terms of things which are at lower loops or at fewer coordinates. So you go down in either the genus of the curve or the number of points. And then finally what you're left with are things at genus zero. And in fact, the only thing that you need as kind of to complete recursion relation, there's one more piece of data, namely what you have to know, you have to know W at genus zero of 2 points, C and W. And in fact, that's given by this Bergmann kernel. So
this kind of looks like the boundary of NGN, but something funny was going on with this NG tilde.
Yeah, so in some sense, this indeed, like in kind of in string theory, looks like really go to generate cases. But the most remarkable thing of this formula is in fact that if you see what you're doing, you're evaluating, it looks like there's some kind of a vertex here, but the vertex is only evaluated at the branch points of the curve, which is in some sense very ugly and kind of non-covariant from the point of view of the curve itself. Because, well, what are the branch points of a curve? That only makes sense if you think of the curve as being projected down to the x-axis, because then there are the points in general 2 to 1, say, or n to 1, and sometimes the jumps. So this really depends, and also, I mean, this choice here, eta appears, so that's basically this preferred one form, y dx. So it looks really like an ugly formula. It really depends on thinking of it in terms of this branch cover, and it also depends on a lot of details, but the theorem is that this is completely unique, for instance, invariant. So in some sense, it only depends on the Riemann surface, together with this one form eta defined on it. For instance, one thing which is, I think, a beautiful theorem, that if you think of this not as a branch cover over the space x, but as a branch cover over the space y, so interchange x and y, the result basically is still the same. So it means that in the end we can define it entirely on the Riemann surface. But of course, very strange that in some sense, if you wish, the interactions are localized to the branch points.
Do you need a condition that the Riemann
doesn't
have
evolution? No. So in general, the only thing that you need is you have to give this definition of...
It does have an evolution.
Because in this case was... For the matrix model I described, it was a hyperelliptic curve. But this actually... The fact is that this holds for much bigger classes of curves. For instance, there is a. If you look at.
What replaces the branch point in this larger class?
Well, it's points of ramification, right? So if you you could have a curve that looks like this or something, right?
So you need a map to P1.
Yeah. You need a map to. Yeah. You want to think of it as some cover.
Well, it could be Cuba. It could be that.
Yes, it could be an n-fold cover, right? But the general, there would be points of, say, ramification points in the curve. And then you sum over these. So, for instance, if you would, just to mention, if there's a much bigger class of matrix models...
For matrix models, you prove this by just standard matrix model technique?
Right, so essentially this...
just a generalization of the...
It's an explicit, so that's how they found it, by explicitly solving the loop equations and seeing that you can write closed formulas.
Yeah.
So there were already results known, but these are sometimes very beautiful. For instance, if you want to solve for F2,
yeah,
there's basically only one diagram in some sense. So you have to, it's in some sense a very, very precise and clean thing. But I should say that there's, in some sense, these equations that you define here, although they are kind of inspired by matrix models, they now have proved to be of much more general applications. Because, for instance,
this to any Riemann surface now.
It can apply it to any Riemann surface. Exactly. And in fact, the Riemann surfaces that were coming from matrix models were curves in C2. But you can now also think of curves in C star, or you can curves even in this T4. Because you still, what you need is a curve together with a one form. So if you're given a curve, you're given a one form eta, then this machinery works. And it defines for you, in some sense, the genus expansion. And in cases where we know that the curve is related to invariants which are defined otherwise, like for instance in topological string theory or something, this has been proven to give the same results. So this is quite interesting. So I would say this is perhaps one of the most simplest possible closed string field theory. That's where we can explicitly compute genus by genus the correlation functions.
If the curve had a ramification point, say order 3, would you have a different
second frame? Oh, that's a good. That's probably yes, probably. Of course, you can always kind of tilt it a little bit so that. I think so. Yes, mm-hmm. Because you will get. Yeah. Perhaps the best way to think about it is taking two ramifications, sending them together, and yes. So now let me kind of try to.
Can you think?
Yes. Yes.
Can you sum this over G and get an equation for nonlinear equation for them? I mean, a generating functional form.
Well, let me write. I give you now our kind of field theory derivation of it, and then you can see whether you. Or perhaps that's the best point to end.
How does it relate to the BCLB?
Sorry.
How does it, relate to today's question? How does it compare to BCLB question?
So, okay, so this should be the dimensional reduction of BCOV from three dimensions to one dimension. And but I think, well...
And the answer to David's question would
yes.
be that it's a wave function, the generation function, the semester equation.
Oh, okay, no, that is definitely true. So when I said that, for instance, if you switch from, say, x-coordinate to y-coordinate, it's not that the function is invariant, but in fact it transforms like a wave function. So that's precisely how we expect it to work. So now let me kind of...
Robert,
yes?
Simple question, I missed yes. a step here. So you start off saying you were going to tell us how to define these FGs.
Yes. Okay, so here I only...
define these more complicated...
Yeah, okay, so there's a... Okay, you're very good. So there's one more step, how to define the FGs themselves.
Yeah.
And that's the following formula. So, yeah, I have a good that you remind me. So introduce one more object, so you locally you can write this one form, right, this was just one form ydx. You can write it as d of, let me call it for the moment, phi classical, which is just a function. And then, I'll come back to it in a moment, and then the fgs themselves, at least for g greater than 1, are given by, I think I'm doing this right. So they also give them in terms of a residue formula, sum of all branch points P, residue Z equals P, of the one-point function. So basically you take the one-point function and then integrate it, essentially. And then you get a partition function. So there's one more step to get the partition function itself. So let me now kind of explain a little bit our understanding of this theory. And so argument was basically the following. So how do we want to think about this theory? We want to think about the following. So this would be a theory that takes a Riemann surface. So we have this curve C, and it has a complex structure. So there's a D-bar operator on it. It's a Riemann surface. And we want to think of a theory where we essentially want to think of a quantum theory of variations of complex structure. So what does that mean? So in general, if you
vary the complex structure, it varies by adding a little piece of del, the del, del operator to del bar operator. And so there's an object mu which is called the Beltrami differential, which is it's a holomorphic vector field and an anti-holomorphic one form. So in general you can think of having a deformation of the complex structure, where you add a little bit, you vary the del bar operator. Now remember, what we want to get in the end, we want to get the invariant of a Riemann surface with a fixed complex structure. So what we want to do is we want to, in some sense, write a quantum field theory for the trivial variations, cohomologically trivial variations, which means that we would look at variations which can be undone by a diffeomorphism. So that means that mu is in some sense the induced change of complex structure by having an infinitesimal diffeomorphism given by a vector field V. So here V is a holomorphic vector field. So we want to have a theory like this, and then it will the complex structure of the Riemann surface as a modulus remain invariant, but we're looking at kind of the cohomologically trivial variations. Now, this actually goes very well with the idea that we not only have a Riemann surface, but we also have a Riemann surface that comes equipped with this kind of mirror morphic one form. And in fact, that's in some sense what we are doing is kind of mimicking the kind of in the BCOV story where we look at variations of complex structures of Calabi-Yau threefolds. So we have this one form eight. So we can also think of, we want to look at variations that preserve the class of this one form eta. That is to say, we would look at variations where the variation of eta is cohomologically trivial, so it can be written as the d of some function phi. Now, what is the variation of a one form under an infinitesimal diffeomorphism? Well, this will be like the Delis derivative of eta. So this can be written as the d of the inner product of v with eta plus the inner product of v with the d of eta. But remember, eta is a closed one form, so this term is absent. And you can see, get a really nice formula. You see that this scalar phi, defined in this way by saying it's the cohomologically trivial variation of eta, is given by the inner product of the vector field with eta. And in fact, this can be solved. You can find that the vector field can be expressed in terms of the scalar as phi divided by eta. Now this makes sense because we're in one complex dimension, so we have a scalar divided by one form, and this gives a vector field. So here we just solve the vector field in terms of this scalar. Now, we want to write a field theory for this. So my claim is that actually this phi will be our chiral boson. So we start to write an action, which is del phi, del bar phi. And in fact, this is precisely the action you would also get if you do the general theory of variations of Hodge structure of a Calabi-Yau threefold and reduce it down to one dimension, you get this this action. So there's another way to justify it. But now you have to do something, because now you want to say, well, wait a moment, we have a scalar field phi, it's coupled to a complex structure, this is a conformal field theory, so it depends on the choice of complex structure. But now phi is basically changing the complex structure in this way, because what it's doing is that the del bar operator gets modified by del bar, well, plus in general mu times del, but mu is now given as del bar v, and v is given by this expression, so we can write this as del bar phi divided by eta. So you see that this becomes a nonlinear theory, because now the complex structure is basically parameterized by the field phi itself, namely in the following fashion. So now you can plug this in here.
And in fact, what you then find is you get an interacting theory, which looks like d phi, d bar phi, plus a term which I can write as d bar phi. Oh, sorry, this is one way to do it. Over eta. By the way, an equivalent way to say that is, well, what happens if we change the complex structure? In general, you would add a term mu times the stress tensor. So this would look like a term mu times del phi squared. But then you plug in mu for this, so you get the same term. You get a del bar phi del phi squared over eta. If you look at this equation, you see it's kind of a funny equation from the point of view of conformal field theory. Because in some sense, remember, this is a field, this is a one form. So it does make sense, because this is a 0-1 form, this is a 1,0 form. We divide it by 1,0 form, so the whole thing is conformal variant. But of course, this, in some sense, is an x-dependent function. So it's like you're putting a coupling constant that's depending on the value of the point on the Riemann surface, so it looks very ugly. But it's very ugly, but also, in some sense, it also looks trivial. In the sense that, in some sense, let me write it again here, and now include the small parameter. So perhaps better to do this directly. So our coupling constant lambda is essentially the scale of eta, so we can also write this as 1 over lambda d phi squared d bar phi over eta. So lambda is over here. So we are expanding this theory, this field theory with the cubic interactions in power of these cubic terms. But remember that what we are doing, so we will consider a path integral with this action, and then we would compute correlation functions of this chiral boson. In the full path interval, these will be the thing I will call W in a moment. And so what we are doing is a theory which, at this point, if you forget about the interaction, is a chiral boson. So the d phi's are all chiral fields. The equation of motion will be the del bar of del phi equal to 0. That's just the equation of motion of this field theory. So we can think of phi as a holomorphic field. So in fact, this interaction here can be written as a total derivative. So the interaction vertex, which is an interaction over the curve of del phi squared del bar phi over eta, can be written as an integral of del bar of del phi squared phi over eta. And this is total derivative. So you might think this is zero, because we are on a compact Riemann surface. But it's not quite true, of course, because the thing we have to worry about is whether this eta has zeros. So the way I think about it, here's the Riemann surface. So there are some bad points. So these are the points where eta has a zero. And we have this integral over the Riemann surface, but what we can do is we can basically reduce this to a contour integral. But it's basically a contour integral around the points P, which are the points where the interaction becomes becomes infinite. So we have to write here, and then here there's a term which looks like del phi squared phi over eta.
So, it is the Beltrami differential.
Sorry?
Is eta the Beltrami differential?
It was closely related, right? The Beltrami differential is basically given by this del bar phi over eta. So in some sense, it's 1 over eta is like the Beltrami differential. So the zeros of eta is something where you get kind of a singular deformation of the complex structure.
Okay.
Right? So that looks like you're...
Okay.
In some sense... So at the branch... So, well, at this point. So... So you already see that this is an interaction that, some sense, if you is localized to the zeros of eta, that's the only place where things are happening. Now remember what eta was. Although we could do this for the general case of a Riemann surface together with a one form. In particular, we are interested, of course, in a case where the Riemann surface is given by some curve in this xy plane, and eta is y dx. So now, when can eta have a zero? There are basically two possibilities. So the first possibility is when y is zero. All right, so that's a point like this. So it's a completely smooth point on the curve. If in some sense that would contribute to this interaction, it would in some sense be very bad, because it's not at all invariant to the surface. And the second possibility is that basically dx equals zero. And when is dx zero? Well, that's really at the kind of branch point. So this is, well, I'm not drawing it very well. So I should somehow draw it like this or something. So this is a smooth curve. This is case one. Case two are the branch points, because if, remember, at the branch points, roughly the curve locally looks something like y squared equals x. And so then dx is y dy, and so clearly goes to zero at the point. So you have to work on it a little bit, but I'm running out of time, so let me summarize what's going on. So let's say something about this step one. In the case one, where y equals zero, that means that we can pick kind of a local coordinate. So in case one, we can pick a local coordinate z, so that the one form y dx looks like z dz. So that's just, we pick this coordinate here. And in that case, what we are having to compute, we have to compute this integral phi d phi squared over z dz. So that's the interaction vertex. And how are we thinking about this in the field theory? Well, in the field theory, it actually means that we, so for those of you who understand conformal field theory, what we are doing is we're evaluating this operator essentially when it's acting on the vacuum of the quantum field theory. And so what you have to do, you have to make a mode expansion of del phi. So the usual mode expansions of del phi. Plug it in here, and you find that actually this operator, as an operator in the conformal field theory, when acting on the vacuum, gives zero. One way to see it, just plug in the mode expansion, and you find that if you plug in the mode expansion, it becomes something like 1 over n, alpha m, alpha k, sum over n plus k equals minus 1 on the vacuum. So it means that there's always an annihilation operator. So this kills the state. So these do not contribute. But however, these do contribute. And one way to understand that is if you're close to a branch point, that actually in some sense, since here the field phi is defined in terms of a double cover, here it's not acting on the vacuum, but here it's acting on the so-called twist field, so on a twisted ground state. So these things do contribute for the branch point. So in the end, what we are getting is a field theory. Well, I cannot summarize it. So we get kind of a variation, say, of the chiral boson, which has an action del phi, del bar phi, and then a period integral around the branch points P on the curve, exactly given by this 1 over eta phi d phi squared, and then I'm putting here also the coupling constant lambda. So it's a kind of a bizarre conformal field theory, but it's you can compute with it, and if you push and you compute order by order by expanding in the cubic vertices, you get some graphical rules, and claim is, you can derive the recursion relations of Einar and Oranta. So there is a field theory interpretation that works very well. And it's a very nice picture, but to make a small, I will stop and make a small advertisement of tomorrow's lecture. If you go back to the theory of a Carl boson, there are many more things to be said about this field theory. But apart from the field theory derivation, which is nice from the physics point of view, I think it's quite beautiful in some sense. There's now this kind of mathematical rigorous theory that computes kind of higher genus invariance of curves. Right? So in some sense, the if you have given a Riemann surface, we knew how to compute like the determinant of the Laplacian, but now there are these kind of higher genus objects that have a very neat definition, and of course the question is many ramifications connected to many other graphs.
Riemann surfaces, it's sort of overkill. Right?
Sorry?
It's overkill.
Why?
What is it telling you about the
Well, of course, the beautiful thing is that these appear in all these in random matrix models, etc. So I mean, it's a natural object to appear in various places in mathematics. Yeah. Right, so intrinsically perhaps not very interesting, but it's interesting because it gives the solutions to all these models.
Are these invariants continuous functions as you deform the Riemann surface?
Yeah, so they are all functions of the moduli of the Riemann, of actually the moduli of the Riemann surface together with this kind of one form. Because in some sense what you always have is you have this pair of a Riemann surface together with the one form eta. So in some sense, from this you can compute these f of g's.
Do you know how this variant behaves under finite sheeted covering?
No, I don't think that people have looked at that.
Under finite covering. In other words, suppose you take a cover of
right.
And pull back the one form, what's the relation?
No, actually, that is a very interesting question. In fact, I'm actually looking at it right now, because in some sense, it's related to, if you go to the other mathematical applications, there is this relation with counting sheaves. And in fact, that's where sheaves, if you remember, for rank 1. And so you could try to consider kind of vector bundles of rank n over Calabi-Yau threefolds in these particular cases. And that's very closely connected to these invariants, where now you look at an n-fold cover of the curve. So there is some relation to it, but I don't think that has been worked out. But I think it's very interesting because in some sense it's a very natural generalization. So the thing I want to talk about tomorrow is that if you go back to the case of the Carl boson, so without this deformation, remember that, so in general you get these determinants, so you get the Z. But this can also be written, so there's a thing called fermionization or bosonization. A chiral boson two dimensions is equivalent to a so-called chiral fermion. A fermion being a section of the spin bundle. And so there is another way to express these partition functions as determinant of the del bar operator, say coupled to some background connection. So we could ask, even for this interacting theory, where the higher genus things are, is there again some kind of fermionic formulation? And what is this fermion then? Is it interacting or whatever? And I think actually there's a very pretty picture, because on this case, what we are going to see is that originally we had this curve C in this XY plane. But you see now, if you include this kind of deformation parabola lambda, that the coordinates x and y become non-commutative, and we are no longer having a curve, but we will get, so the curve C will deform in a so-called D-module for this non-commutative algebra. So there is again kind of a nice dual picture, where instead of the bosonic theory, you think in terms of the fermionic theories, and we will get D modules. But I will discuss that tomorrow.
So the fermions will be free, but
it will be free but non-commutative. Essentially, that's the punchline. And in some sense, that also fits very well with things that go back at least 20 years, I think. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So I have three questions.
Yes.
First, so now that you have a field theory,
yes,
you can ask about non-perturbative
theories. Right.
Are there any?
I don't think actually this bosonic theory is able to capture this, because
it could.
I would be very much surprised, but I thought
what
you
know,
you could look at, yes, so you could say, well, look at the you have some
classical
equations. Yeah, I briefly looked at it, didn't see anything interesting, but it's
very. Do you expect number?
In some sense, I feel I expected earlier in the fermion language.
Of course, there are.
There are, yes. Yes.
So they should be captured here. I mean, it would be pretty weird if you had a natural definition of the essence of the.
No, but remember, in the matrix model, the non-perturbative stuff comes. Remember, we're only doing here the settle point approximation, right? So non-perturbative stuff is going from one settle point. Yes. Right.
You have the whole essence.
Yes, that's true.
So you say, I really find it very surprising if you had a natural definition that, I mean, that asymptotic expansion is not summable.
Right.
So it has to have non-perturbative direction.
Yes.
This is natural. It should be embodied in.
Well, but this is also kind of an ugly field theory, right? But
no,
that's a good point.
So the second question,
yes,
is, if you try to make it less ugly,
yes,
by putting the metric back in, is there a nice call for that? I mean, you said it was all independent, but you could be able to stick the metric back in. How does that? I'm just wondering how it looks.
But, sorry, it only depends on the complex. I mean, it's conformal, right? So
sure.
You want to. So you want to.
But
put
the first term, I know how to put the metric
right
back in.
Yes.
In a way that's only conformal.
Yes.
Diffeomorphism and random.
Right. Yes.
The question is, but the second term.
It's kind of ugly, right? Because you're dividing by one
right
form. Yes.
So, but
yes,
there must be some way of writing in a manifestly covariant point.
Well, one thing you can. You
or maybe not, but. Anyway,
good point too.
The third issue was, you know, is there equal any progress of the same order of magnitude on multi-matrix models?
Well, so let me say one thing. So the most general class to consider here are these kind of two-matrix models, right? So the most natural class to consider. Is the matrix the two matrix model where you integrate dx dy and then compute some, you know this very well, so with two potentials, and then the curve essentially is something like y minus w prime of x minus v prime of y plus dot dot dot. So you start with this theory, which is kind of has many double points, and then you deform it. And in fact, in this you can get a very general class. For instance, here you can get these minimal models that will, like, for instance, if you want to get something that goes like y plus x to the q, they are all sitting in this class of two matrix models. So in fact, arbitrary algebraic curves can be engineered by this class of model.
Is there a similar formula for?
No, I think for now it's only these two matrix models. You might think of more like chains of matrices or something, do something similar. But I think actually my intuition would be in some sense following this logic,
yeah,
of our field theory derivation. You would get naturally way derived the Feynman rules. Yes.
Thank you.